I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Wesley Lowery has been covering police-involved shootings, community police relationships, and the rise of Black Lives Matter for The Washington Post. It all began in Ferguson, Missouri, with the death of Michael Brown in August 2014, where he interviewed Brown's family and learned the history of the tense, often hostile relationship between the police and the community. He was arrested in Ferguson at a McDonald's where he was working, charged with trespassing. Here's a clip.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Here's a door over here. Let's go. Let's go. You can move. Let's go. Move.
Sir, please.
Let's move. Let's move. Let's move this way. Here's the door. This way or this way.
Wesley Lowery has written a new book. It's called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, covers law enforcement, justice, race, and politics for The Washington Post, and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. What does the title of your book refer to?
And so They Can't Kill Us All is it's in quotation marks. It's from a sign from a demonstration in St. Louis. This was after the death of Antonio Martin. And so Antonio Martin was, I want to say, the second or third person who'd been killed by the police in Greater St. Louis after Michael Brown. This was at the point where it seemed the police were insisting, you know, this is not happening. It's not something that happens very often. These police-involved shootings are rare. And then the evidence seemed to be presenting otherwise. And I think Antonio Martin, like I said, was the second or third person. And this was the kind of case that the police or supporters of the police would say is a quote-unquote good shooting, right? This was someone who had a gun, who had threatened an officer, and yet there was still – the community was still so upset about this, and people struggled to understand why. And I remember covering that vigil and that protest, and there's a sign that someone left. Antonio Martin was killed near a gas station. Someone left a sign on a piece of cardboard that said, you know, they can't kill us all. And I thought that, you know, much of this book attempts to grapple with why so many people have been in the streets, kind of the ethos and the ideology of the protest movement. And I think that there have been many messages sent by the demonstrators over the last year, but one of the primary ones, both verbally and also just physically by their bodies being there, is that we're all physically here. You know, they can't kill us all. So that's why we chose that for the title.
In fact, you were part of a group of Washington Post reporters that began to investigate, I mean, so much of the more current police-involved shootings have been in the news, but there was a question about how common was this? How often does this happen? You didn't know, and apparently no one really knew about the numbers of police-involved shootings.
Of course, and so when we started covering this, you know, so prior to Ferguson, I covered Congress. I was a political reporter for us, and when we started covering this, you would have the civil rights groups and activists and residents, and they'd say that Black men, unarmed Black men, were being gunned down in the streets every single day. And then the police and the police unions would insist, you know, this never happens. It's a one-off. It, you know, this is so rare. Most officers never even draw their weapons, right? And so because we had good editors, I would, you know, type these quotes up and send them in. And they'd say, okay, but which one is true? Because they can't both be. Either unarmed Black men are being gunned down in the streets every day, or this is a rare thing that never happens. And so we started calling around. We started looking into this. And, you know, the attorney general must know this or the DOJ must know this. And it turned out
there must be records somewhere, right?
Well, it turns out there aren't, right? And so it turned out that the federal government wasn't keeping any accurate statistics on how many people are being killed by the police, that most state governments were not keeping accurate statistics about how many people were being killed by the police in their states. In fact, that the most robust and comprehensive database and tracker of this was killedbypolice.com, run by some anonymous people we don't even know, you know, just literally just keeping a list in a spreadsheet. And so we got together and we said, you know what, this is something that perhaps we could do or we should do. That, you know, when people are – we're a country that counts everything. We know how many barrels of corn there are in Iowa. We know how many shark attacks there were in Southern California last year. We know – you know, we are statistic obsessed in this way, yet we don't know how many people are being killed by agents of the state, by police officers carrying taxpayer-funded guns and taxpayer-funded bullets, killing taxpayers. We just thought that that didn't seem – there seemed to be some accountability missing there.
So what is the truth of that matter?
Well, and so we've now done this project for 2 years. We're wrapping up our second year of tracking in real time fatal police shootings. We found that there's between 2 and 3 fatal police shootings a day in the United States of America.
Let me just underscore that. 2 to 3
fatal police shootings
a day.
Now, again, and we're only talking about shootings, so Freddie Gray or Sandra Bland would not be in that. Someone who's killed by a taser might not be in that, right? These are just people who police have drawn and fired their gun at, and that is what kills them. So 2 to 3 a day. In 2015, we tracked 990 or 991. I forget where we landed exactly. And then this year we're on pace to be just about there as well. You know, we're into December now and we're nearing 900. We think we might fall a little short of 990, but we think it's going to be about the same number.
And how many of those are fatal? Do we know?
Well, all of those. All 990 are fatal. We're only tracking fatal police shootings,
okay,
right? And so, again, that's not even the people who the police shoot at and miss or don't kill. This is only people who are shot and killed by the police.
We should underscore the fact that this is what the Pulitzer Prize was about, the fact that
yes,
you and other reporters at the Washington Post dug into those numbers.
Yes. Well, and so then we did a series of stories in addition to building and compiling the database where we were tracking them. And we were doing this largely off of local media coverage that we would then kind of report behind. All right. So Philadelphia, there'd be a shooting in Philadelphia. And so the Inquirer or the Daily News or whomever would report that there was a shooting. And then we would – all right, they've said Tim Jones was shot by the police today. Let's put him in our database and then we can reach back out to the police and confirm the basics of it. So we're building this out based off of kind of these Google alerts from the entire country. And then we dug in and did analysis of the shootings themselves, right? So we started seeing trend lines. We see, a lot of these seem to have mental illness being a factor, right? I wonder how many, right?
I'm surprised to read that.
And so it ended up being, you know, we think somewhere between a quarter and 50% of our fatal shootings end up having some level of mental illness or emotional distraught being, you know, factoring in, right? How many of these are cases of people who are armed or dangerous or actively shooting or stabbing at an officer? Well, you know, a large number of them. How many are of unarmed people? A smaller number, but still a significant number of them, right? And what could perhaps be done differently in those cases? How many officers who shot and killed someone last year had previously shot and killed someone? Well, we found over 60 of them looking at just 9 months of the year. We didn't have the whole year, as he said. And so
– So patterns are beginning to emerge?
Well, of course. And this idea that – without the data, how could we have – these were all unknowable things, right? When you start looking at things like mental illness and how it factors into fatal police shootings, that can then inform your training. It can inform your tactics. It can inform – I say this all the time. If a quarter of the people who police were encountering or if somewhere between a quarter and a half of the people police were encountering were diabetics, every officer would be carrying insulin shots, right? We know that, right? There's no way we would say, well, I wonder what we should do with all these diabetics we're seeing. How are we going to deal with this, right? And yet we've got, you know, many of the people who our police are dealing with and in a large portion of those who they are killing, we know are in the midst of some type of mental or emotional health crisis. And yet so many of our officers are not properly trained.
Yeah. And I was just saying it's not you can't give someone a shot to deal with their mental illness. But certainly training is a big factor in trying to de-escalate.
Well, of course, because many of our officers, especially when you're dealing with someone who may be armed with a pen knife or a screwdriver or some type of sharp object that they might have, right? But if there's someone who is perhaps they're schizophrenic, perhaps they're in the midst of a manic depressive state, maybe they're all of the things that that officers often do in a situation will in fact exacerbate that situation. Sorry, this someone is armed, so I need to crowd them and yell at them and seize command of the situation. Well, if someone's in the midst of someone's hearing voices, if someone's in the midst of a crisis and a breakdown and you start pointing guns at them and screaming, it's pretty guaranteed to make the situation worse, right? And so, again, a big part of this fact, you know, if we don't know who police are interacting with in these fatal encounters, how might we better equip them or inform them to prevent them? We can't. And that's, I think, why the counting of these shootings was so important.
Let's go back to Ferguson, which was the summer of 2014. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the death of Michael Brown sparked such a powerful movement, if it was Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter, or certainly a national response? I mean, in many ways, we got to see to some degree what was happening in Ferguson, but why do you think that sparked such interest?
Well, I think Ferguson was in many ways a perfect storm of a lot of societal forces that had been bubbling for a long time, right? Beginning with the new tools and equipment that the people themselves had, right? The first
video cameras, right?
And cell phones and social media, right? The first reports from Ferguson, Missouri are from a young rapper who is sitting in his apartment watching the shooting outside the window and is tweeting his reaction, photo of Michael Brown's body, the photos of Darren Wilson walking around, right? And so
that was a guy named Emmanuel Freeman, right?
Yes. And so he's the first – that's the first dispatch. It's the first time anyone knows Michael Brown's name, and we don't even know his name then, right? But the first scenes from the moment after that shooting. Then you have people start to gather and they start to crowd. They see this. They're concerned by it. And then they get concerned by the police response. They're seeing dogs. They're seeing heavily armed people. They're seeing, you know, the mother arrive and is upset and she's getting turned away and she can't go. And that exacerbates this. You know, one of the biggest things, I talk about this all the time, is, you know, Michael Brown's body lays in the street for 4.5 hours.
Yeah, I remember that.
And this is in a street that cuts through Canfield Drive Apartments, which is an apartment complex. And so you have a lot of people who are – hundreds of people are looking out their windows at the dead body of a teenager for 1 hour, for 2 hours, for 3 hours, for 4 hours. And it's this thought of what – if this is how they're treating this, shouldn't he be in an ambulance? Shouldn't they have covered him? Shouldn't they take this? It's this idea of this is how it felt, this callousness. And so if they'll treat him this way in death, what must have happened to lead to this, right? And I think that on top of that, you know, what we know now is that, you know, the people of Ferguson and St. Louis County broadly were dealing with policing that the Justice Department has concluded was largely racially discriminatory, that the way that fines and fees were used acted as a tax and a means of kind of terrorizing these people, that any interaction with the police could immediately turn into something that upended or ruined their lives, where they were getting these fines and fees that they couldn't pay in the first place stacked on them, then taken to jail overnight. And so – in many ways, Michael Brown's death became this line in the sand where people said, you know what, we put up with this aggressive policing, we put up with these fines and fees, we put up with this kangaroo municipal court system, but we're not going to put up with dead kids in our street. Mm. And I think there was the kind of a line that was drawn.
And we're almost up in our first break here, but I think for many of us outside of Ferguson, also seeing the police response where it looked more like a military response than local law enforcement, tanks.
Well, yeah. I mean, large armored vehicles, large armored equipment, you know, tear gas and the rubber bullets. I mean, it looks like these scenes look like scenes that we're used to seeing from war zones as opposed to in American cities. It had been a while since we'd really seen unrest like this. And so I think that was very jarring for a lot of people.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Wesley Lowery is our guest in this hour of Radio Times, part of a team of journalists at The Washington Post that received a Pulitzer Prize earlier this year for their coverage of police shootings. His new book, They Can't Kill Us All, begins with his coverage of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, the death of Michael Brown. He also talks about some of the other police-involved shootings and the tension between police departments and some of the communities that they serve, raising a whole host of questions about race and safety and violence and crime. 1-888-477-9499, the phone number to call to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen talking with Wesley Lowery. He covered the shooting death of Michael Brown in the summer of 2014. In fact, our guest was arrested at a local McDonald's where he was working. His experiences in Ferguson led to more stories about police-involved shootings, police-community relations, and the rise of Black Lives Matter. And again, his book is They Can't Kill Us All. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from T. Can Wesley talk about the five-second law, the law in which people in Ferguson couldn't even tie their shoes without the threat of being arrested? True?
Yes. Well, and so it was called the 5 second rule, and this was something that the police implemented during about a month after Michael Brown was killed, right? And they're trying to figure out how to deal with these massive protests. And day in and day out, the policing strategies would change. And so at one point, they implement this so-called 5 second rule. And what they say is that everyone who's involved in the protest or in demonstrating can't stop moving for more than 5 seconds. And then anyone who has stopped walking for more than 5 seconds can be arrested for a failure to disperse. So essentially there has to be this continuous motion. Now at the time, kind of in the you know, kind of in the chaos of the moment, it was like, oh, that seems reasonable. Everyone kind of like went along with this thing that now is like kind of patently ridiculous. Of course you can stand on a sidewalk for 5 seconds. Like that is, I mean, like that, like that's a very obviously, you know, and how might you do all types of things that you are allowed to do in public, like tie your shoe or set up a voter registration tent or like, you know, hand out bottled waters to the people who are protesting in August, right? Any number of things that are totally constitutionally protected behavior. Where so you had all these people, and eventually, Arch City Defenders and the ACLU, a few groups locally as well, sued over this and got a ton of arrests thrown out because there was this idea that they were arresting people because they'd stopped walking on the sidewalk while participating in a protest, and that which we all know now, like removed from that moment, is kind of ridiculous.
Your book is about what happened in Ferguson, what it was like to cover it, and other places as well. It's also what it's like to be a journalist, a young African-American journalist covering, as you say, so much death in many ways. You also use the word parachute. I mean, essentially, you parachute into Ferguson. You ended up parachuting out of Ferguson. What are the disadvantages of being an outsider covering a city where there is – there are so many stories, but so many things that you just are not going to know about unless you live there.
You know, I think one of the disadvantages is that you have to spend the time getting to learn the place where you are. You have to do a lot of reading. You got to do a lot of informational interviews. It's not – everything is not as one for one.
Right.
Well, I've talked to two people, so now I know everything that – you know, you have to do much more homework. But in the same way, you're also not – you know, I think there's a massive advantage, though, to being an outsider coming into a story like this, especially a charged story like this, because you're coming in with clear eyes. We get used to the unique ways that the places we live operate, right? And in many ways, when someone else comes in, like, this is kind of crazy. Wait, you guys do what? Or this has always been? Or this is how this – I mean, we look at the things – Ferguson's a very example of this, but you look at the way that speeding tickets were being used or the fines and arrest warrant. You know, the day Michael Brown's killed, there are more warrants active in the city of Ferguson than there are residents because they would very aggressively give tickets. And then if you didn't pay your speeding ticket, you'd have an active warrant out for you. And everyone knew that in St. Louis. It was just how this operated.
And almost accepted it or just said this is the price of living in Ferguson?
And how were they going to fix it? What were they going to do? And then we all come here like, that's kind of crazy. What do you mean? Like that doesn't – why would you police this way? This is – and so you need – you know, there was a lot of great journalism that came out of these stories. There was a lot of great journalism all of a sudden being done about diversity of police forces or use of force policies and specifically in greater St. Louis. But those were all stories that could have been written the Sunday before Michael Brown was killed, right? As a, you know, and they were not. And so I think that that speaks to, right, very often, unfortunately, because of the way our industry works, is we are reactionary to the thing in front of us.
Sure.
And so all of a sudden there's lead in the water and we know about it because there are kids getting lead poisoned, right? As opposed to like 2 weeks ago when there was lead in the water and we didn't have the time or the capacity or the idea to write it.
One of the things that you had to do, and reporters on the ground have to do this, especially dealing with a crisis, is to deal with interview people who are in mourning, in grief, in upset. I know you talked with Michael Brown's mother. Mm-hmm. There are those, what I think of as kind of horrible and rude, how are you feeling type questions. How did you deal with that?
Well, that's difficult. It's something that you unfortunately get better at over time. You know,
my
job now is to talk once or twice a week with the family of someone who's been killed by the police, right? And very often in close proximity to when the shooting has happened. You know, there are times where I'm talking to someone, you know, I did an interview with a mother in Georgia whose son was killed by the police in January, right? So she's had more time to kind of process this. I talked to her last week. But there are other times when Philando Castillo was killed, I'm talking to his sister as they are still in the hospital, just having found out that he was dead. And you have to, you know, I remember I read about in the book in Charleston after Walter Scott is killed.
Yeah.
And going up to his family and being in his family home and trying to kind of negotiate in my own head how I might handle this and how I might be respectful of them. Like being in this space that felt familiar, you know, that here's this family that lives, you know, kind of down a, you know, a small quiet road in this house full of family photos and just trying to grapple with, I'm walking up to you on the worst day of your life. How can I not be like obnoxious about what I ask of you? And I think that's a a big consideration, because so often it's a, well, do you think you're going to get justice? And don't you want the protesters to be peaceful? And it's like, this is a mother who just lost her son. Right. Like, I mean, and I think we have to remember that sometimes.
Well, and as you write, you know, part of it, you're talking to strangers and you're saying to a stranger, trust me with your story, mm-hmm. trust me with your emotions, but you don't know me.
Yeah, you don't know me, and you also don't have a ton of reason to trust me, right? The thing is, we all, I mean, as members of the media, right, I always jokingly say, like, no one hates the media more than, like, other people in the media. Like, yeah, I agree. We screw it up all the time. You know, like, and that guy.
Because we know these things, right?
Yeah, exactly. We know these things and these people, right? We know that, you know, I might handle this the right way, but I hope that other reporter doesn't get this, or I hope that – and so you understand – When you come to someone's doorstep on a day of tragedy and chaos in their life, and you're asking of all these things for them, you really are extending this request for trust, and knowing full and well that there might be very reasonable reasons for them not to give it to you. And so it's interesting to try to grapple with that as well.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY. What is it? WHYY Radio Times. And again, our guest is Wesley Lowry. He's a reporter for The Washington Post and won a Pulitzer Prize, part of a team of Post reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize documenting police-involved shootings. And again, he's got a new book called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bernie from Pennsauken to join us. And Bernie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I've been listening. Now, to start out with the fact, I'm blind, so I was unable to see any of the televised stuff going on out there. But one thing I had heard at that time was that a funeral director had been sent out there to pick up the body, and the
mom
wouldn't
Michael Brown.
Let him anywhere. Yes, and the mob would not let him anywhere near the body. Now, the other part was President Obama sent his own attorney general to oversee the whole procedure, the autopsies, that sort of stuff. And this police officer was never indicted for anything. And the report I had heard was that they found the DNA of Michael Brown on the revolver of the police officer. And, you know, I'm just wondering
sure.
how – and also one other thing, NPR had sent out a young female reporter at the scene the day after the shooting, and she said, here are two black gentlemen here. I want to talk to them. And one of them – she asked them, and one of them said Michael Brown was a thug, and the other one said he was a thief. That was never, ever heard again on NPR.
Well,
The only thing ever heard was that teenager Michael Brown, which meant that he could be a 12-year-old to turn 13 today, or he could be a 280-pound, 6'4" man, and he'd have been very, very insulted if you'd have called him anything else but.
Well, you know,
so
Bernie,
I'd like to hear the report.
Sure, and I'm looking at Wesley's book talking about Michael Brown. He robbed a liquor store, got in a scuffle with a police officer. I mean, that certainly was a narrative, and my understanding was that he had had taken something from a local corner store shortly mm-hmm. before his altercation with the police officer.
That's what we know now. You know, I think that – so there's a few things, a few things to unpack there. So – you know, first, there certainly was a crowd that gathered the day Michael Brown was killed. It's unclear specifically the exact timing of when. Perhaps they attempted to bring it. It wasn't a funeral director. It would have been the medical examiner. But at some point, there was certainly someone called. It's unclear. It probably certainly was after an hour or two. And what we also know is it was at least, you know, 2 hours, perhaps 3 hours before the body was even covered, something that could have been done within minutes. When we look at this conversation about what information was known, how things were covered, and then what the results of these investigations were. I think there's a few different things, right? So first of all, we now know, we now have benefit of hindsight that the people of Ferguson were not given and not granted, right? That in those first days, the police had said nothing about what happened. There was no explanation of that there had been this potential robbery, that he that Michael Brown matched description, that there had been two separate altercations, one at Darren Wilson's car at which he drew his gun and Michael Brown reached out to deflect it or to grab it, and the gun went off hitting Michael Brown, which creates his DNA on the gun.
Sure.
His blood is what is on the gun. And then that Michael Brown ran away and Darren Wilson chased him, and that is where the fatal interaction. You know, so there are two different altercations here, which raises the question of, you know, what tactically should Darren Wilson have done? Does he need to get out of the car? Does he need to chase? Does he – and then it raises the question of what is happening in that fatal moment. Just because someone attacks you once, it doesn't necessarily mean they did again. But beyond that, I also think we have to remember, and this is what we know, that we have to look at these shootings. When a police officer, an agent of the state, kills a taxpayer, kills a resident, right? When the government kills someone, we have to look at it both with a real scrutiny and a desire to ask hard questions, but two, we have to look at it as, is this something that's possibly and potentially preventable? We can't – I think very often we look at these shootings in a – either it's legally justified or it's not legally justified. Well, what we know is that the way our system works is we give police officers wide and broad latitude. Almost no shootings are legally unjustified, right? Even ones that most people will watch on video and say that shouldn't have happened, because we allow police officers to do basically whatever they want. And then on top of that, when the feds come in, right? So to be clear, when Eric Holder, the attorney general, comes in, he's not overseeing the local police investigation. They are running a separate investigation that has a separate burden of proof. So a federal civil rights charge for a police officer is an almost insurmountable burden of proof. There was no way they were ever going to charge this officer with that, right? And so people try to use that as a means of saying, well, see, even Obama's Eric Holder said this thing was fine. Well, that's not really what happened, right? They said that there was not enough to justify charging someone with a federal civil rights crime, which is a pretty large, you know, indictment.
One of the people that you interview in your book, and this is talking about, I guess, parachuting in and parachuting out of Ferguson, he says to you, you're going to write your story, you're going to leave town, and nothing is going to change. One day, 1 month, 1 year from now, after you leave, it's still going to be screwed up in Ferguson, using a slightly different word there. Do you think there's some truth to that? Are things different in Ferguson?
I certainly think there's truth to that. I mean, there are things that are obviously different in that, you know, some of the businesses have been rebuilt or some have not been, that there's a new police chief or a new city manager. You know, there are certainly changes, and there are also, you know, officers are wearing body cameras, that type of thing. But one thing that's interesting is that, and I draw this from a lot of reading I've been doing about lynchings during the Jim Crow era, is that you would have these places that would have this kind of cataclysmic event occur. And everyone else would say that thing was horrible. That shouldn't have happened. Everyone else in the country would like spark this dialogue and learn a lesson. And the place where it happened would never learn the lesson because everyone was too close to it. They were too upset, right? Everything was the media's fault. We're not these backwater racists as we've been portrayed. No one really understands it. No one gets us. What's wrong? That there's this that people feel victimized by the news story, and so therefore they're incapable of potentially learning some of the lessons or having the conversation that everyone else is having, right? And so you end up with these scars, and we see this not just in the legacy of lynchings, we see this in the legacy of the 60s and 70s unrest in many cities, right? You have places where there were riots and neighborhoods that are still not rebuilt. Huff in Cleveland is still not rebuilt. Sections of Los Angeles that's still in sections of Baltimore where literally there was no lesson learned there. Everyone just left and ran away and gave up on this neighborhood, right? And so I do think that there is a – you know, I haven't been back to St. Louis in a little while. I'll be back soon. And every time I've been back, it – you know, there's still this feeling that there is a scar there that you know, has not quite healed.
You write about, you know, your beat covering what we've been talking about. You said the dead look like my father, my younger brothers. They look like me. Does it make it hard for – I mean, I don't know. You know, objectivity and the press is, you know, something that I think it's almost in the eye of the beholder. But does that make it hard for you to be dispassionate. I'm not even saying you should be dispassionate.
Yeah.
About this.
Well, I don't know that I should be either. I mean, I think that there's a, you know, I think one of the biggest lies we tell ourselves is that we can ever be objective about anything we cover. Right. We're all human beings. We all have lived experiences. We bring those experiences into our the stories we cover. In fact, there are layers upon layers of subjective decisions that go into any story, even the most straightforward news brief, right? The beginning with the idea that this is news and should be covered versus this other thing that should not be. Well, that's a subjective decision that is subject to our own beliefs and experiences, right? And so I think that it's important rather than trying to like catch this focus on that. Like I think one of the things I think is important is to – have a focus or to strive after a level of fairness, right? And fairness and comprehension, right? So am I covering this from all angles and with depth? Am I asking the right question? Am I chasing a specific thing? Is this about accountability, which is one of the things I try to focus on, right? My focus is on accountability, right? Is there a policy that wasn't followed? Is there a policy that does not exist currently that would have prevented this? Is there a systemic issue here, right? For chasing those questions as opposed to kind of coming in and saying, well, I quoted the victim's mom, so now I need to quote the guy from the police union. Well, that's not like actually, no, because the guy from the police union isn't even directly involved in this, and this is the mom of the dead person. Yeah, I think that sometimes we get caught in this both sidesism that undermines our own journalism.
And we're almost having a break here. One of the things that you – and I appreciate your honesty about trying to cover these stories. It's part of this book as well, which is to be skeptical of official sources. I think that's something that we should all be. And also just the notion of trying to keep your distance from activists and organizers. Yes, using them as a source, but but not being their scribes, I guess.
Well, of course. Well, and building relationships. You know, I'm someone who kind of nationally is seen as very close to many of the activists, but I've been cursed out by all of them over stuff I've written or how it's – you know, because I think that there's something to be said for – but I think that – well, you have to take people seriously when you cover them. And I think that's the key.
Hold on to that thought. We're going to take a very short break. Get back to our conversation talking about a whole bunch of things with our guest, Wesley Lowry. His book is They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. And he's part of a team of Pulitzer Prize winning Washington Post reporters. He covers law enforcement, justice, race, and politics. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have a comment from Mike. Have you interviewed anyone in law enforcement, officers? And he goes on from there. You did. You did a story about the Fresno Police Department.
Of course. Well, and I talk to police officers every day. Right. You know, that's part of my job.
But I think some people might, listening to this, think that you're anti-police.
Well, yeah. And some of them are going to think that no matter what. I mean, we often construct these black and white constructs, right, where like you don't like the Iraq war, so you hate the troops. Well, that's not – I mean like we all know that's not fair or true, but people are going to say that. I think one thing that's important to remember is that I mean most journalists who cover institutions and cover them critically do so because they think those institutions are important, right? The police are one of the most important parts of our social fabric. If millions of people have a vitriolic distrust of the police, that's a huge social problem for us, right? And so it's in all of our best interest to figure out the causes and the roots of that, and if there are things that we can do and change about that, to do so, right? And I think that's important. Also, you know, the role of the media, the fourth estate in our government, is to provide scrutiny and criticism of powerful things, right? There's nothing more powerful than being a police officer. Barack Obama can't pull out a gun and shoot you and kill you. Hillary Clinton can't. Donald Trump can't. Every single police officer in the United States of America has that power, can do that, right? No, I talk to police all the time, and it's interesting because the politics of policing are fascinating as well, right? You have many police chiefs who, frankly, agree with many of the protesters, who think that many of these reforms need to be enacted, who think that there need to be changes in how this industry operates. Yet the rank and file very often aren't as bought in, and the unions certainly usually aren't as bought in. And so you see this divide, in fact, even within policing itself, of what should happen, what this should look like, and this kind of, you know, this very, in many ways, primal response of the rank and file when there is criticism, to feel besieged and to feel attacked. And I think that that is often a big impediment to the implementation of police reform.
Let me ask you a couple of personal questions. You talk about a little bit about your family here. Your father's black, your mother's white. You write that in December 2015, your dad said, "I never had to tell you or your brothers that you're black. The world was going to do a pretty good job of telling you all that." Mm-hmm. Did your dad have the talk with you and your brothers?
Well, no. I mean, and that's kind of where that comes from, was that we were then, my dad and I were having this conversation, you know, now as I'm a grown adult. And I'm back home, and we're talking about all these things I've been covering. And we never did. You know, I didn't live in a house where we had a ton of conversations about race, but we also didn't hide or weren't in any way ashamed of it. Right? It's very like my middle name is like Swahili, and I have you know we went to Kwanzaa programs, or I was always surrounded by a diverse set of playmates and by people and around black people. Like, you know, I think but it didn't have to be something that was limiting in terms of the way that we talked and were raised, but it also wasn't something we were like obsessed with. And so I think that was important. But I think that, I also think that speaks to, though, kind of this broader conversation. And that conversation is one that's about how race impacts our lives, right? And I think that for black Americans and many brown Americans, that race is a non-negotiable factor. That from the time you're in elementary school, you understand. I remember the first time I couldn't go over to someone's house to play video games when everyone else from the bus stop was, because his grandmother didn't really like black people, so just you shouldn't come over here, right? Now, that's not a thing that would be a factor to literally my next door neighbor, the white fourth grader, didn't have to deal with that, right? Now, that's a small example, but you look at how, you know, I write in the book about my dad giving this example of my grandparents. And driving across North Carolina to go from one relative's house to another relative's house. And my grandmother being militant about, has everyone gone to the bathroom? Have you gone? My dad kind of mouths off being a kid. Well, it doesn't matter. It's like a 20-minute drive. Who cares? And she tells a story. She goes, "Have you ever been in the car and had to go so bad that you have to go to the bathroom? You'll jump out the window. You've got to go right now." Well, imagine having that and then finally finding the rest stop and pulling up and someone saying, no, you can't go in here. You've got to go around back, or there's no restroom for you here, right? This idea that for generations, black Americans have had to make every single decision, including have I gone to the bathroom recently enough, based on how their skin might be a hazard to them, and how they might be embarrassed or inconvenienced or physically threatened and harmed, right? That's an experience one section of our country deals with and thinks about, and another section of the country has the privilege of never having to think about. And I think that
something as basic as that.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have so much issue sometimes finding common cause when we have these conversations.
Let me read a couple of comments, and we got some callers as well. An email from Richard: "I'm grateful that journalists and researchers are examining police tactics in general, including analysis of any discrepancies across race, ethnicity, and class." Let me get Lori from Westchester to join us. Hi, Lori. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Lowry for collecting the data on people who are fatally shot by police. And I was wondering if that data includes data on race. Mm-hmm. And if so, how it breaks down. For example, are people of color more likely on a per capita basis to be shot by police than white people are? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure. Thanks. Lori.
Of course, Lori, I really appreciate that question. That's a question we get all the time. I'm actually literally pulling up our database as we do this. Because the short answer is, yes, we have collected the data this way. And yes, we have run the racial breakdowns. Now, this is such a kind of politicized part of this conversation, and our data allows kind of quote-unquote both sides to try to wield it in ways that works for them, right? So the vast majority of people who are shot and killed by the police are white men, in the same way that the vast majority of people who live in the United States are white men. But when you start breaking it down by population, you start to see these kind of racialized disparities. And so to start off, it's both true broadly across all police shootings that specifically black men are overrepresented in the people who are being shot and killed by police. But it becomes even more disparate when you start looking specifically unarmed people who are shot and killed, right? So black Americans make up 12% of the population, but they make up about 24% of the unarmed people who are shot and killed by police. And so you're ruling out your bank robber and your murderer. You're talking about people who are not carrying a gun, not carrying a knife, who are killed in situations that largely otherwise perhaps could have been prevented. Why is it that – and it's also true that when you focus specifically just on race, when you look at just black people who have been killed by the police in one bucket and then white people who've been killed by the police in another bucket, a black person killed by the police is more likely to have been unarmed than a white person who is killed by the police, that a higher percentage of white people killed by the police are armed with deadly weapons than black people who are killed. And that's where you start getting into a conversation about things like implicit bias, right? Is there something about our culture and our society, our media representation, that might lead you to believe that that 14-year-old black kid is really a 28-year-old and that cell phone in his hand is really a gun? What might in our heads lead to that perception, right? And we started to see some research about kind of these ideas of implicit bias and the role of that in policing.
Let me see what Michael from Chester County, what Michael has to say. And Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a student in the Master's of Public Administration program at Villanova.
Okay.
And I actually deal with this data all the time. And I have a number of issues with what this author is actually saying. For instance, his recent comments about a black man with a cell phone. I'm assuming he's referring to the shooting that occurred of the young man with the airsoft BB gun in Chicago. At many junctures, I've actually shown images of the airsoft BB gun compared to the actual firearm equivalent. No one so far has been able to discern between the two.
And you're saying, Michael, I don't want to get deep into this, but you're saying you're looking at the same data and coming up with a different conclusion? Looking at the same data that our guest has been looking at?
That is correct. This is a farce.
So what is the data you've got?
Yeah, what is
And also, I wasn't talking about when I'm talking about a man with a cell phone, I'm talking about a man with a cell phone. I didn't raise the idea of toy guns. That's a totally different conversation that I wasn't having.
Well, it's just the way that you're framing the entire conversation. Specifically, if we're going to talk about the case with Michael Brown in general, before you referred to the legacy of Jim Crow. During the Jim Crow era, do you think that a black man under the influence of marijuana walking down the street would have had the temerity to reach into a police officer's vehicle and attempt to take his gun?
Might have. I mean, might have.
That's just ridiculous.
I mean, that's not true. There's plenty of examples.
How can you even begin to compare that period of history with the way that any of these cases have been treated? I mean, Michael Brown had committed strong-armed robbery before he then assaulted a police officer and attempted to take his gun. Every single one of these cases that we've seen over the entire case of the Black Lives Matter movement have shown that, you know, when you put it in front of a jury and you give people months of time to analyze the situation, every single one of them gets debunked.
Well, let me ask you, Michael, then about Philando Castile.
Well, obviously police officers are not perfect people.
I thought you said every single one got debunked.
Well, I don't put that in the category of every
You said every single one from Black Lives Matter got debunked. The John Crawford video where the guy's standing in a Walmart and they come in and shoot him and kill him. There was no debunking there. We watched it on video.
Well,
Walter Scott got shot in the back while he ran away. There was no debunking that happened.
You're taking two examples that have started protests. You're taking two obvious human errors, which are actually being contributed to by the narrative that you're framing. You're encouraging people.
Oh, wait a minute, Michael.
Alert authorities and SWAT people. That is part of a larger hysteria that your part of the media is actually creating in the United States.
All right, I'm going to end our conversation now because I think you're getting a little bit off the reservation there, Michael. But obviously he's pushing back, Wesley, on some of your findings.
I mean, people have our data and our statistics have been analyzed by any number of academics. One of the reasons we created this was so that people can look at the raw data and analyze it. Now, I think that, again, there's a few things there. First of all, there's not much to be gained from comparing different levels and histories of different type of racialized trauma, right? So comparing Jim Crow to slavery doesn't make any sense in the same way that comparing police relationships to Jim Crow does not make any sense. In fact, the only reason Jim Crow came up in this conversation was, again, drawing what lessons do the places that are home to these events learn, right? And that is a parallel because the type of trauma that Money, Mississippi went through after Emmett Till was killed there, right? The idea that the white people felt besieged the same way the white people Well, Ferguson felt besieged. That is a parallel, right? Obviously, you don't want to draw parallels between the specific incidents, right? But beyond all that, right, I think that represents kind of how polarizing and vitriolic these things are, right? That there's this idea that few people are capable or are willing to have a conversation that actually looks at the nuances of these incidents. That when Michael Brown's killed by the police in Ferguson, we can sit here and analyze the behavior of the dead teenager for hours if we'd like to do that.
Sure.
Or we can say, who's the guy who we pay? And is there a way that we perhaps could have instructed him that would have led to a different outcome? That could be productive. Analyzing the behavior of a dead teenager is never going to be productive. And I think that's just something we got to remember.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me throw something else out here, because you do write a little bit about President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And also perhaps the frustration coming from members of the Black Lives Matter, who see, as you write here, and this is dealing with a couple of these events, seeing his words as condescending, moralizing, and perhaps even overly defensive overly political. Do you understand, I guess, the it's not exactly pushback, but the fact that there are certainly members of this organization and millennials who just don't embrace our president?
You know, I think that one of the things that's been interesting, and I kind of go into this in the book, but one of the things that's very interesting is that many of the people who become kind of the demonstrators, the leaders, the activists, were people who were very bought into the idea that President Obama sold when he was running in 2007, 2008, that they believed in the kind of power and the transformational power of a black presidency, and that they were so excited and mobilized by his candidacy. They were talking about people who canvassed for him, who worked for him, who door knocked, right? And then Barack Obama is elected, and what changes is almost nothing in these lives, right? You can remember, you know, a moment of activists in Ferguson talking about, you know, I voted for Barack Obama twice, but Michael Brown's still dead. Trayvon Martin's still dead, right? This idea that there's a limit to representational politics, and that simply the presence of a black man in a powerful place did not necessarily mean that the threat posed by, you know, black skin was going to be dissipated. And I think that is one of the reasons. Why do people protest? People protest when other means of politics have not served them, right? It's not and I think that's what we forget sometimes. We look at a demonstration and say, why don't those people go vote? Why don't they go run for council themselves? In many cases, these people have voted. In many cases, and they are still unhappy. And so protest is a means of creating political pressure outside of the system to pressure the system to do things that perhaps it otherwise won't do.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but do you think we are as divided or maybe more divided when it comes to issues of race based on your reporting, or are we making any progress?
Well, I think we'll never be as divided as when half of the people were treated as some human and in chains, right? I think that when we look at polling on this, more people think we are divided, but I think that more people accurately assessing something does not necessarily mean that the thing is bigger than it was previously, right? I don't know that it would. I think that over time, our divides do start to dissipate as we start to unweave kind of a system of white supremacy that we built into the system. But I don't know that we're any more divided than we were the day that Barack Obama was elected. Mm-hmm. We're probably less divided.
Less divided. Well, Wesley Lowery, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. He's been covering law enforcement, justice, race, and politics for The Washington Post. And we've been talking about his new book called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era of America's Racial Justice Movement. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. We always enjoy a vigorous conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.